KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You listen, if you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, Pixar scored big with Up this year. That makes those guys 7 for 7. We'll chat with a member of the company's original brain trust and the director of its latest hit about Oscars, 3D, and making movies that almost everybody loves. Plus, James Cameron's Avatar cost hundreds of millions to make. So how much green does it need to earn to get into the black? But next, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stay close. It's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood,
I'm joined in the studio by my fellow banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. John, how are things?
I have left the LA Times holiday party to be with you, so...
So, speaking of cheerfulness, let's talk about the Golden Globe nominations. We are not... no huge surprises, I don't think, huh?
Well, I think the surprises were the movies that ended up being left out. You know, the movies that maybe a month, 2 months ago, people who worry about Oscar predictions or Golden Globe predictions would have thought had a chance. And Peter Jackson's Lovely Bones got one nomination. Bright Star didn't get any.
Yeah.
The Road doesn't look like it's going to be a contender. So I think it elevated the chances for some movies, specifically Up in the Air, Avatar, and Inglourious Basterds, and really kind of clipped the wings of a couple other movies.
Now, we're going to have to just speak for a moment about the passing of Roy Disney, which happened this past week. You know, I think that Roy Disney was, as he himself observed, was considered the idiot nephew. And yet he had a tremendous impact on Disney and on animation generally.
Well, there's a fantastic documentary that's coming out early next year called Waking Sleeping Beauty, which is a look at the 10 years from 1984 to 1994 when Disney kind of relaunched its animation division.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's a little bit Beauty and the Beast.
To Lion King.
Aladdin, all of those hits, yeah.
But I think it also showed how central Roy Disney was to that. And I think it also illuminates how, with any successful enterprise, and Roy Disney was certainly part of this, that once, you know, sometimes the more successful you are, the more tension there is. And there was a lot of internecine war and between Roy Disney and Jeffrey Katzenberg and Michael Eisner. But you can't take away what animation accomplished in that period in which Roy Disney was very central to its execution.
He also oversaw twice an overthrow of the regime at Disney. He started out overthrowing the sort of leftover from the Walt Disney days administration. And then after Michael Eisner had been in that job for 10 years, he turned on Michael Eisner, which is something I have to say I never thought I would see when I covered the company in those days. And he pulled off a stunning shareholder revolt. Meanwhile, back in Hollywood, business is booming, right? It's a crazy time. There's going to be, by the time you're hearing this, as we will talk about further later on in the conversation, Avatar will have opened to a certainly very substantial number. And there are competitors rolling. It's like O'Hare, all of the incoming gigantic jumbo jets are coming in now, huh?
Well, I think this coming weekend is going to be huge. I mean, we have Sherlock Holmes. We have It's Complicated. We have Alvin and the Chipmunk sequel. We have Nine.
Squeakquel.
Up in the air in wide release. Avatar in its second weekend. I mean, a lot of people who think this could be the single biggest weekend in Hollywood history, which would be about $260 million of total grosses. So I think the real question is, do these movies cannibalize each other, or does the marketplace expand to encompass all of them? But I think for any movie, especially the more expensive movies like Avatar and Sherlock Holmes, the true test of their profitability is going to be told, you know, in the middle of January, Super Bowl weekend. It's going to be well into the new year before we know how well these films have done.
And Hollywood is already looking at a record year. So, you know, those movies, some of which, many of which are old-fashioned movies. When I'm not talking about Avatar, but, you know, something like The Blind Side. These are old-fashioned movies, and they are doing great guns, and it makes you think, you know, that as they hasten into the future, which is, it's happening with Comcast now, where they're unveiling this thing that where you're going to be able to see all kinds of movies and TV shows on the internet if you're a subscriber to Comcast. You know, as they rush into that future, they do need to protect that theatrical window, because they're going to be minting money with these movies.
Very much so.
So the future is now, and do you think this would be like Comcast might be looking at those box office numbers and saying, well, geez, maybe we better not shove all this stuff online and on demand so quickly, because there's money, there's gold in those theaters?
Well, it's the one revenue source that seems to be holding steady. I mean, I think what you have to remember is even if domestic box office is going to have a record year, DVD income is plummeting, piracy is taking off. You can only show a handful of movies in China, the biggest market in the world. So I think as great as domestic theatrical box office might be, it is, you know, only one good sign in an otherwise, I'd say, very troubled business right now.
Oh, dear. And on that somber note, I think that's all the banter we have time for.
How's that for holiday cheer?
Ho, ho, ho. All right. Thank you, John. That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. By the time you hear this show, James Cameron's long-awaited sci-fi adventure epic, Avatar, will have opened to some very big number. But remember, the total cost of making and marketing the film was staggering, and Fox will have to share the box office with its production partners and theater owners. So how much did it cost, and how much does it need to make in order to be profitable? Dave Poland is the editor-in-chief of MovieCityNews.com. Let's just break it down, because there's been so much talk about numbers with this, some of which is provoking.
Yes.
Let's start with cost. How much do we think this sucker cost? We've seen low numbers from some internet sites. We've seen high numbers, notably from the New York Times. What do we actually think the number is?
My actual guess would be between $250 and $300. I think, you know, they were just finished the picture, so what the actual number is, I don't even know if Fox knows at the moment, but it's somewhere probably in between there. Fox's number is about $240. That means it's probably a little low, but yeah, I think that the New York Times number was a bit high.
Which was about $500 million or something.
Well,
right?
they added in marketing, which they never do unless they want to make a splash by saying $500 million or something like that. And they didn't probably take into account, they kind of added in, I think, the support of other, you know, people like Panasonic who were involved in the production and gave a certain amount of stuff to the movie. But that doesn't generally count against your bottom line unless you're trying, again, to get to a big number to make a splash in the newspaper.
And how much do we think they're going to spend to sell this thing?
I think pretty standard, the $150 million worldwide. You know, generally speaking, almost every movie of any size from a studio cost at least $100 million to market worldwide. This one will maybe cost $120 to $150. The big thing that I don't know is how many deals they have with other organizations to share the costs. You know, in other words, if Panasonic's running an ad that features Avatar, that's a deal they've made with Fox, that Fox is not paying for the ad. And, you know, a lot of studios have done very well, Sony in particular with the Bond movies, by crossbreeding through their advertising budgets and taking $20, $30, $50 million even from other people's advertising budgets.
How much money at this point then, what's the magic break-even number? Can we guess? We have to kind of guess.
Well, my feeling is that the magic break-even number is probably, in terms of what the final number ultimately is against box office, is that you're looking at a movie that needs to do around 570, something like that.
I think most people would find that sort of surprisingly low. Is that because the cost has been hyped so much?
Yes. The thing is, nobody counts the rest of the numbers unless, as I say, they want to make it sound bigger. So in a movie like Star Trek, for instance, not a profitable movie in spite of all the hype about it, people didn't count the $120 million in marketing against it. They didn't count the real budget against it because the studio would never admit it. Plus, the movie was well-liked. There wasn't kind of the negative hum around Avatar,
right,
has been around Avatar. So the press decided to take a soft-shell look at it. Generally, that movie needed to gross about $450 to break even. Avatar's a little bit more expensive.
But we feel that it will get there at this point.
I personally think it'll be the second highest grossing film in history.
Obviously closing in on Titanic, but not passing it.
I don't think it'll be even close to Titanic. I think the Titanic number is a number we may see again someday, but we're very unlikely to ever see again. I think this movie is looking at $400 to $500 domestic and probably around $800 worldwide.
That's a pretty big number.
That's a very big number. But these, you know, when you look at what Harry Potter does and what Batman, even Batman was a little smaller overseas, but you know, these numbers are doable overseas. This is a very big visual movie. Nobody's going to walk out of the theater feeling they didn't get their money's worth. And it's perfect for international. And Jim Cameron's history is that his international box office is usually done at least 40% better than domestics.
Now, it used to be in the old days that you, in order to figure out if a movie was going to be profitable, you sort of doubled the domestic gross, and that was the sort of the break-even number. That was like the rule of thumb. Is that just a dead rule?
It's a dead rule because of DVD. DVD changed that whole dynamic, and now it's changing it again because the DVD business was so huge that it really changed how you made your profits and where the money was. We're now sliding back to more of a classical scale because the DVD sell-through business has dropped off so much.
Right.
So,
and that's a bit of a wild card, too, for Avatar because, you know, do you buy the DVD when it's not the 3D experience?
Well, the question of whether the 3D experience is absolutely necessary will come up also because they won't be in only 3D theaters. And they're, you know, going to play for a long time, presumably, so they're going to have to figure that out as they go along and see how audiences feel. I don't think this is a case like Coraline, for instance. Coraline got hurt badly when they lost their 3D screens because people really wanted to have that special 3D experience. In this case, I think the movie is going to be a big enough spectacle, even if you don't have the glasses. So
it is an e-ticket ride, and people are going to like it. So.
Well, it's a great entertainment. It's a movie, but so is Titanic. Titanic is not,
same
you know,
thing, exactly.
Titanic was not Citizen Kane.
I noticed that.
But it didn't
that,
aspire
yeah.
to being Citizen Kane. This movie is every genre movie you've ever seen smashed together in different ways, including his own.
David Poland is editor-in-chief of MovieCityNews.com, king of the internet. Thank you so much, David.
So fun to be here.
It's been an incredible year for animation, with films like Fantastic Mr. Fox, Coraline, Ponyo, and Pixar's latest. Up is the story of a grumpy octogenarian who flies his house to South America.
This summer, Disney Pixar will take you on their next great adventure. With Carl Fredrickson. And he won't even have to leave his house.
Come on, boys!
With movies like Toy Story, Finding Nemo, and WALL-E, Pixar's success is nothing short of phenomenal. But analysts and industry watchers predicted that Up would finally ruin that perfect batting average. They said the movie was too somber. They said kids wouldn't go for a movie about an old man. Of course, they were wrong. With a worldwide box office of $683 million, Up was a hit, and Pixar remains the envy of all Hollywood. The Northern California company was built upon the creativity of its original brain trust. John Lasseter, Ed Catmull, Andrew Stanton, and our guest today, Up director Pete Docter. At this point, you know, we've seen animation come along to the point where there's a very impressive list of animated films coming that have come out.
Yeah, it's a banner
year. A really good year. And do you feel at this point like that category in the Oscars is ghettoizing your films? Or because I know there are people who expect and hope that your film will be nominated in Best Picture, but...
Well, I mean, we really think of these just as movies. We happen to use computers to create the images that you see as opposed to a film camera. But it's the same process along the way. We talk about, you know, not only story and structure and, you know, character arcs and motivation, but also, you know, wide shots, overs, two shots. You know, we talk about lighting. The whole process, the creative process is exactly the same as live action. So having said all that, I guess... The nice thing about having an animation category is that I think there does a lot of films do get more attention. You know, we're talking about these movies that probably would otherwise have just been passed over completely.
Right.
So it's nice in that sense.
I mean, the big stumbling block is that actors don't buy that it's a movie in the way that you were talking. They, as long as there's an actor at a lectern, they don't feel, and that's the biggest voting block in the Academy. So I don't know if there's a way to overcome that. You know, it's going to be this is something that Jim Cameron has been trying to campaign on with Avatar, that it's not motion capture, it's performance capture.
Right.
And that it's driven by the performance. And you can't quite make that same argument, but I don't know. Maybe you'll never be able to persuade the Academy that that you know, that those actors to embrace those films as Best Picture contenders.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would love to invite those folks in to say with Tom Hanks, you know. And I remember talking with him. He said that, you know, this is one of the more intensive, exhausting films that he does. Yeah, that he's done is working on these on Toy Story, just because it's 4 hours of intensive acting. You don't get any downtime on a live action set. You've probably been, but you have like 15 seconds of action and then an hour and a half of sitting around watching people
at
reset
least,
lights
yeah.
and things.
Mm-hmm.
And ours, for us, it's just, okay, next take, go again. So it's very intensive. And he has to have so much imagination. All the actors, you know, they're sitting in a room kind of like we're in. It's mostly, you know, panels on the walls, a microphone, and nothing else. They have to create their own performance as well as whoever they're acting against, because 9 times out of 10, they're not even in the same room.
Right.
So, you know, I can see on a lot of these guys' faces, working with Christopher Plummer was the same thing, where he would ask me, how close am I to this person? And you know, what's the room like? And so on. And you could see him adjust his performance based on specifics like that. So
I'm going to switch over to the whole Pixar thing. You've
okay.
been at Pixar since you were 20, since like the day you graduated from college.
Yeah. I went to CalArts just north of here in Valencia and started the day after graduation.
How many years does that add up to?
It's coming on 20. This next year will be my 20th anniversary.
Yeah. So, and you've seen huge changes, of course, because Pixar, of course, is now, I'm not sure, is Disney part of Pixar or is Pixar part of the Disney?
Well, I guess if anything, they've tried to import the Pixar culture to Disney in the form of John Lasseter and Ed Catmull. But they've really tried to make it their own thing. I think the Pixar philosophy is, look, you hire these great artists and then let them do what you hired them to do. It's, you know, I always
what
think,
a concept.
Yeah. But most studios, I think, you know, the executives want that control. And understandable, there's a lot of money at stake. But I can't imagine hiring, say, a plumber and then standing over him and say, no, use the 7/8-inch Langley wrench, you know. I mean, he knows what he's going to do. He's going to either do it right or not. And if you trust him, then on you go. So Pixar has brought on these directors and story supervisors and all the people that work there, and we just let everybody work the way they want to work and make the kind of films that we want to make. So we're not trying to – like another question we get asked a lot is – the films appeal to both adults and to kids, and how do we do that? Who are we aiming for? You know, who's the target audience? And the only answer I've come up with is us. You know, I'm trying to entertain John Lasseter or Andrew Stanton. If I make them laugh, then I've done my job. And so in a sense, I guess, as a director, half of my job is making the movie and the other half is watching them.
So has life changed for you as a director since the Disney deal happened?
Not really. If anything, I'm almost more... Life is a little simpler because it used to be I'd pitch to John and whoever else at Pixar, and then I'd go in and pitch to Disney. And now those are kind of the same thing. So if I pitch to John, then I am pitching to
You're
Disney.
You're done.
Yeah.
Simpler. Now, John, I just read very recently in the LA Times, he's off designing princess dresses for Princess and the Frog and getting very interested in toys. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you see less of him than you did before?
We do, definitely. You know, he's splitting his time between Pixar and Disney. And the thing about John is he's interested in everything. Like you give him a subject, you know, Kleenexes, and he'll tell you, oh, yeah, I visited a Kleenex factory. See, it was 15 years ago. And he can go into all the processes of how they manufacture it and what percentage of reclaimed wood or whatever.
He's so just, interested is actually an understatement. He's sort of
he's
obsessed
just,
with everything.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much. And so it doesn't surprise me at all to hear that even princess dresses, you know, I could see him really getting into that and figuring out, like, what causes the ruffles and, you know, what kind of fabric is used and all that. And that's, I think, reflected in our films, that attention and focus on detail is there on the screen. At least we try to.
We'll be back in a minute with Pete Docter, the co-writer and director of Pixar's latest hit, Up. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. We want to know what you think. Write us at thebusiness@kcrw.com or go to the comment page for today's show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. The Pixar Animation Studio has an unprecedented batting average in Hollywood. 7 feature films since 1995, and all of them home runs. When Disney bought Pixar in 1996, some feared the deal would hamper Pixar's creative freedom. As if. Pixar genius John Lasseter took the helm of all Disney animation, and he's managed to put some life back to an operation that seemed to be adrift. But that means Lasseter has less time to spend at Pixar. We're talking to Pete Docter, one of the original Pixar employees and the co-writer and director of their latest hit, Up. So with Lasseter less present, who fills in, or does it work differently? Do you feel like, well, I want John to see this?
Well, of course, we'd love for him to see as much as we can. I think now, having worked together for nearly 20 years, I have a kind of intuitive sense of what John will respond to and how his brain works to some degree. And there's a level of trust, I think, that develops over that time. So
you can kind of channel John.
Hopefully. And then we do have him definitely for key moments. You know, we just met with him on yesterday morning to pitch something, a new idea. So,
Yep. I'm curious what that is, but I won't ask.
Okay, thank you.
John is also not presumably immortal, as far as we know, right? Are you bringing along a younger generation? Who are the stars of tomorrow?
Yeah, well, we're trying to. I mean, there's definitely up-and-coming folks. Pete Sohn, for example, the guy, he actually did the short film at the head of Up called Partly Cloudy. It was about the stork and where babies come from.
Right, right.
He is definitely an up-and-coming talent. I mean, Bob Peterson is another guy who is not – I mean, he's been in the trenches working with us for a long time, but he's developing a film on his own. So, you know, we're trying to do as best we can both continue with the films we're making and train new people for the future.
I mean, is it like they're rare as rubies, these people, and you have to kiss – I'm mixing a lot of metaphors here. You have to kiss the bunch of frogs to get the princes?
Yeah. I mean, it's just – Well, looking around the studio, I see so much talent that I'm so thankful that I'm already employed there. I don't think I would get a job.
I wouldn't make the cut now, huh?
No. They're just really talented people. And I guess that's a benefit of, you know, doing the work we've done and having the success. People watch the films and they're sort of drawn to Pixar. And so
you're the it place.
Yeah.
But where are the princesses? Where are the lady people?
Well, we do have Brenda Chapman. She's working on a film.
She's been around for quite a while.
She has. So that'll be fun. I think that film, they've got like about 2.5 years or so before that comes out. And so they're starting to really fall under the eye of Sauron or whatever. You know, that's the time when things really start heating up.
Do we know what project this is?
Yeah, it's called The Bear and the Bow. Mm-hmm. And it's a great, great film. It's really fun and really different. And that's the other thing I love about what we do is we try to make things, you know, from film to film. It's not like you always get,
buddy
films or musicals or whatever. You try to shake things up so that you get something different. And this is definitely different.
So the Eye of Sauron, what is that? When does that happen?
Well, that's like the last 2 years or so.
Long time.
I know. You have a 5-year process generally. So from concept, you work about 3 years. You're getting the story right, rewriting and working with the story crew to reboard, storyboard stuff. That's kind of where the thing really happens. It's like an extension of the script process. And then the last 2 years is when you've got to get stuff into layout and animation and lighting, and you have all these reviews. I mean, I get in the morning at 8 o'clock, and my assistant will hand me – we have a dance card, and I'm scheduled down to 5-minute increments the whole day up until 6 or 7 p.m., knowing exactly where I have to be at all times. Bathroom breaks aren't even included in there, so they get mad at me when I have to go.
Jeez, was that a cult that you used to where they wouldn't let you go to the bathroom?
That's right. Keep going. Next meeting.
Now, I'm wondering what, you know, you were on Toy Story, and that's already been done in 3D.
Right.
What do you think of that whole thing? Is that really necessary? You did Up in 3D.
Yeah, we did. On Up, and I'll just speak as myself as a director, we developed the film, and it was about 3 years before we even talked about 3D. So we were really thinking of it as just a traditional film. And as I mentioned, for myself, when I go to a 3D movie and there's stuff coming out at you, you know what I mean? Things
flying
in your face and things. I'm distracted. I feel like, oh, yeah, I'm in a theater wearing glasses. And what I want from a movie experience is just getting lost and not thinking about anything else, just losing yourself in that reality. So on this film, I made a conscious choice between that and the knowledge that by the time home video is involved, like 95 or more percent of the viewings are going to be in 2D. So I didn't want any decision to compromise that. And we designed it all to work very nicely in 2D, but then when you see it in 3D, it's just got this added layer to things that just is very immersive, for lack of a better word.
So is that what you're going to do from now on, or that was, you know, a thing to play with?
Well, we tried to use it as a storytelling device as well. And so in that sense, I guess it's another crayon in our crayon box, so to speak, of tools to be able to tell the story. I know John's very interested in continuing that on, but I think, frankly, it comes down to the audience. You know, are they going to be – so far they seem to be really responding, and most people really like it. Weirdly, okay, here's my observation. It seems like people under the age of 35 to 40 love the 3D. Mm-hmm. People over that age prefer the 2D. They're distracted and annoyed by the 3D.
Their brains are
there,
like,
are exceptions, but
we don't
that's
like it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Brad Bird, who did The Incredibles, is working on a live action film. Is that something that tell me a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, Andrew Stanton is working on one as well, and he's, of course, the director of Nemo and WALL-E more recently. And, you know, I think it's just more proof that, for us, a story is a story. You're focusing on those same things of what's going to happen next, and does this character motivation make sense, and the change and growth that the character goes through. I don't really know. They're not being released as Pixar films, so those two guys are working outside of the studio of Pixar.
I mean, is it an intention to keep Pixar as animation and not make Pixar other?
Yeah, I think so. I think there are enough other opportunities. Like if, you know, Andrew and Brad are working on live action, they could work with Disney feature film. And so it just makes things a little easier to understand, you know.
Right. So you guys are have built a studio in Vancouver.
Right.
What's up with that?
We have done at Pixar a number of projects that are sort of ancillary and separate from the main work we do. So, of course, we'll work on these features and short films. But then we'll also do animation for rides at Disneyland, or, you know, product tie-in kind of advertisements with sponsors or whatever. And those are a real big draw, a drain on the studio. So the idea was, let's set up this studio in Vancouver that will do projects like that
Why
we think
Vancouver?
Are fun. Well, there's tax breaks up there. It's a little cheaper to run things.
It's the money, honey.
Well, you know, a lot of this stuff, it's like either we have to find a way to do it cheaper or we have to just cut it out and not do it. And I think the intention is, this is certainly true now, all work feature films and short films are still being done in Emeryville in Northern California.
Well, okay. So, Pete, I have to tell you, I'm a little disappointed.
Uh-oh.
I was reading about, you know, your socially awkward youth, and I was expecting some guy was going to stare at the table. And you've been very personable and answered our questions in a very nice way. So
thank you.
It's been a very enjoyable conversation.
Good. Me too.
Pete Docter is a member of Pixar's original Brain Trust. He co-wrote both Toy Stories and WALL-E, and co-wrote and directed Monsters, Inc. His latest film is Up, which he also co-wrote and directed. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Darby Maloney is our associate producer. Our theme music mashup was designed by beat architect Jason Grohman. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. If you have any questions or comments about the show, write us at thebusiness@kcrw.com. You can also listen to this or any past program and comment about the show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can listen to our podcast, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button from our new media player at kcrw.com. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.